Hello, and welcome to Eyes on Success, a weekly program of information on the ever-changing world of accessibility. Now here are the hosts of this program, Nancy Goodman-Torpy and Peter Torpy.
Hello, I'm Nancy.
And I'm Pete. On this week's show, we're going to talk with somebody who went blind very suddenly later in life and see how he dealt with that and what kinds of things he does now.
We'll speak with Rodney Rowe, who at the time he lost his sight was a practicing pathologist, and we'll hear how he changed his life around and how he now finds much enjoyment and fulfillment. But first to our tip of the week. This week's tip comes from Rodney Rowe.
There are two ways to do things. When you have a life situation like this, you can pick up the pieces, figure out how to put things back together and go on with your life, or you can curl up in a ball.
And those are sort of the options. I mean, sometimes life doesn't always deal us the cards that we'd like, and how we deal with it will determine how life turns out for us and how happy we are.
And that applies to many, many things, whether it's suddenly losing your eyesight, gradually losing your eyesight, or any number of other things. We're not always dealt the hand that we wished we were dealt.
So let's hear how Rodney dealt with some of these issues.
Turning now to our low-tech item, we'll meet Rodney Rowe.
Can you start by introducing yourself?
My name's Rodney Rowe. I'm retired. I live in North Georgia with my wife of 46 years. We have lived in various places in the country. I'm a retired pathologist, and I retired in 2005 because of my vision loss. In about 1998, I got interested in pottery and still do it. I grew up in Arkansas. I went to school in Arkansas, went to medical school there, graduated in 1968. We've lived in Arizona, in Tennessee, Iowa, Missouri, and North Carolina.
Can you describe your visual problem?
I can tell you that it was the 17th of December in 2005. I noticed a little smudge in my vision. That was a Saturday. On Monday, I went to see the ophthalmologist, who told me I had ischemic optic neuropathy. You could probably best describe it as a stroke in the optic nerve. The blood supply just became insufficient for the nerve. So it killed part of the nerve right behind the eyeball. That was in my right eye. About a week later, it happened in my left eye. And that's unusual, because for people who have ischemic optic neuropathy, unless it's due to arteritis or some kind of systemic illness, it usually just affects one eye, and about 20% of people get it in the other eye, and it may be months or years later before it happens. So mine happened the next week. The effect of that is I have no peripheral vision, and I have spotty central vision with my right eye, which used to be my good eye, being worse than my left eye. What's left is sort of like poorly done ground glass, so that in some areas I have a real blurry image or no image, just perception of light. Then I have spots where I can see. The good thing, I guess, in a way, is that because mine was not due to arteritis, it was stable, so I still have patches of central vision. I now have macular degeneration, so I suspect that that's not going to be the case into the future.
Now, as a pathologist, your job was basically to look at things in detail and say what diseases people had. That must not have worked too well after your eyes failed.
Now, I tell you, okay, so on the 19th, I saw the ophthalmologist. I worked the 20th, the 21st, drove 5 hours to Wilmington, and while I was in Wilmington, it progressed to the point where the family was leading me around, because initially I actually had worse vision than I do now, because I got hemorrhages in the back of my eyes and things like that further obscured my vision. So I came back me and my wife drove home. I just handed her the keys somewhere in Wilmington and said, I'm done. And we drove back, and I went to see my partner in my medical practice and told him that I was retiring and that I would call the accountant and the attorney, and we'd get things set up to turn everything over to him. So by the first of 2006, I was retired.
So we talked to a lot of people that, you know, if they're blind like myself since birth, it isn't a big transition. It's sort of life is, that's the way it is. And there are many folks like yourself that go blind later in life, and yours was rather sudden. I was wondering if you could comment on how you felt about that. That had to be a huge transition.
You can probably hear my voice.
Yeah.
It was a huge transition. Most of my hobbies were visual, and I was always good at things that required good hand-eye coordination. So suddenly things like shooting skeet, shooting billiards, all kinds of things that I used to do and enjoy were no longer an option to me. And I couldn't work. I went from working full time to not working at all in basically about a 2-week period of time.
Often on this show, we talk about how even after you've lost your vision, there's pretty much nothing you can do. But it seems that some of Rodney's pastimes are the exceptions to that.
But, you know, I'm always amazed when you see how people do modify some of these games. We talked recently with someone who knew about blind people playing tennis. They modified the rules somewhat so you can get an extra bounce, and they had like metal beads inside the balls so people could hear the balls. So sometimes there are some modifications that can be made to make it possible to do some of these different sports or activities.
And sometimes the modification actually makes the sport have a different name. So if you can't shoot skeet, you can shoot at a target, and that would just be called target practice. But as long as it's stationary, you could probably figure out how to hit it. And maybe you can't play billiards, but you could play darts, which has the same social setup. But fortunately, some of his other pastimes were amenable to being able to continue doing them even after he lost his sight.
In January of 2006, I thought I was doing pretty well, but looking back on it, I was severely depressed. My wife had to come in and tell me to get out of bed, and she would take me to the city park and walk me in circles in January in the cold rain just to get me out of the house and keep me doing something until I could kind of get my self straightened out.
Must take a while. So what was the transition that, you know, kind of made things successful? I mean, it sounds like you're doing pretty well now.
I think having a very supportive spouse helped a lot. And she was a psych nurse at one time, so she understands about depression and what you need to do for somebody who's, I mean, I was acutely depressed, and it was due to situation. So the situation wasn't going to change, but I don't know, sometime in that period of time, in the first month, I just made the decision, you know, that there are two ways to do things. When you have a life situation like this, you can pick up the pieces, figure out how to put things back together and go on with your life, or you can curl up in a ball. And I decided the thing to do was to try to do the best I could with what was left of my life, which hopefully would be a while, because I was 63 at the time. And so Lynn and I worked on things together. I think it was pretty successful. The other thing that helped, I looked at the things that I used to do that I could still do, and I put my energies into that. It was a transition. There's no doubt about it. And there are days when I say, you know, I really hate the fact I can't see. I'm still angry at times, but most of the time I don't think much about it.
Now, I'm fully sighted, and when I met Pete, he was already blind, so I thought I knew what I was getting into when I married a blind man. But Rodney's wife, Lynn, has kindly agreed to be interviewed for a future show, and we'll be talking to her about what it's like if you've been married to a sighted person for a long time and suddenly your partner becomes blind. And I'm sure there's a lot of people whose partners are in a similar situation who are listening to this show.
One other question about making the transition. Was there special training, mobility training, or using adaptive aids that you had to go through in the process?
Absolutely. When I got home, I'd been to the ophthalmologist, and he was somebody I'd known for years, and basically he just said, well, you can't see anymore. Come back and see me in 6 months. And I thought, I'm not going to get any help here. And I went home, and I got Lynn to look up the Lions Club and called the president of the Lions Club and said, I'm new at this. Can you offer any advice? And he said, well, first thing I would tell you to do is to call the social worker. In North Carolina, every county has a social worker whose job it is to be the go-to person for blind people. So I got a hold of a woman named Sarah Palser, who was the social worker in Cleveland County, North Carolina at that time that did this. And she came out, spent, maybe an hour with me, found out that I was a veteran. And she said, oh, are you in luck? Because the VA has excellent rehabilitation program for blind people.
And the VA, we have a lot of foreign listeners. That's the Veterans Administration.
Right. The U.S. has a system of hospitals for veterans through the Veterans Administration. They do a good job with taking care, not of emergencies, but long-term care of people. And they have blind rehabilitation programs scattered throughout the country. So in the fall of 2006, I went for 7 weeks to Augusta. I had living skills instruction, visual skills instruction, orientation, mobility, manual skills, computer training. I'm probably leaving something out, but it was a combination of a lot of really low-tech things like learning how to use a cane and high-tech things like learning how to use Zoom text on my computer. I suspect as my macular degeneration progresses that I'll depend more and more on the speech.
Well, boy, that's a real testament to your drive and persistence to have made, such a successful transition in such a short time. Many people have at least some period of time to make the transition and sort of ease into it.
Yeah, I've discovered, one of the things that happens when you're in a rehabilitation program, you're exposed to other people that are in the same situation. That was also very healing. Because to suddenly be surrounded by 15 or 20 other men and women who are having to deal with what you have to deal with or worse makes you feel like you're not alone.
The other interesting comment I thought you made was when you said you talked to your ophthalmologist, and I've had the same experience or the same feeling with ophthalmologists is, they're very good about treating what the functional issue with the eye is. And, they'll tell you whether you can see or not or whether they can fix it. But as far as knowing how that will impact your life and what might help you use your functional vision to do the things you want to do, they're not very good at that, or even in terms of recommending what to do.
That's exactly right. That was my experience. And I think they're just not oriented that way.
You are listening to Eyes on Success. 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 Success.
This week's focus topic is doing pottery with a visual impairment. Rodney, I understand creating pottery has become a large part of your life. Is that something you started doing since losing your vision, or did you do that beforehand?
It's something I took on before I lost my vision. So we enrolled in an adult education course in a community college and would go one night a week for 3 hours. And I like throwing things on the wheel and making functional pottery. By functional, I mean plates and bowls and pitchers and, things that people use. So we did that for a few years. Did not have our own kiln, didn't do our own glazing. We used the glazes and the kiln at the school. Then Lynn got into a studio that involved artists working with multiple media. There was a woman who did big stained glass installations, a painter, a weaver. About a year after I lost my sight, one of the members of that studio dropped out, and I moved into her spot. So for about 3 years, I was in a studio with several other artists doing various things. And during that period of time, I bought my own wheel and learned quite a bit, taking just online courses, going away to workshops and that sort of thing about working with clay. Then after we retired, we moved to Georgia, bought our own kiln, bought a slab roller, some other higher ticket items to do the pottery with. And then the bottom dropped out of the economy and people stopped buying much of anything, which has kind of slowed us down as far as making things is concerned. But it's been sort of a journey and something that I've really enjoyed.
So this actually evolved from an adult ed class into a hobby, into a business?
That's right. That's right. Basically, as far as the business was concerned, it's been going to shows or putting things in galleries.
So you must travel around a lot to these festivals around the country? Or?
We have done that. No, we don't do it much now. As I said, the economy has just kind of made it. If you go to a show, there's a fee to enter.
Sometimes pretty steep.
Some of the shows are juried shows, which means that somebody has to look at your work and decide whether or not they think it's worth going into their show. Others have a fairly steep entry fee. And if the economy's bad, you may not even make your entry fee. And you've had the expense of traveling there and setting up. And so it's a lot of artists that we know have become very selective about where they go.
And where do you display your work locally?
I'm going to put in a plug for our local guild. We belong to the North Georgia Arts Guild. We have members from all over North Georgia, some from southern North Carolina and western part of South Carolina. We have shows that we have our own guild table, shows that we sponsor. We also are involved with other people's shows. So that's been a source of networking. I'm actually on the web team for the North Georgia Arts Guild. I do a couple of things for them. I do the links to other sites and so forth.
Oh, well, that's perfect, because then we can put a link into our show notes and you can tell us what the web address is.
It's northgeorgiaartsguild.com.
I gather throwing pottery on a wheel is fairly tactile and you can probably do it better if you don't look at what you do. But how do you do the glazing?
That is a source of major problem. What I've come to do is either do surface decoration without glazing, and you can do that with colored slips that you carve through and things like that. The issue that I have with glazing is that I can't tell how thick the glaze is, and I can't tell if I've missed spots. And I've had several nice pieces that I've made that I've glazed and then discovered that I had a dime-sized place that didn't get glazed.
You know, the same thing happens when Pete tries to make his own peanut butter and jelly sandwich.
There are some bare spots.
There are bare spots.
And thick spots.
Right.
So have you managed to find any more successful techniques for applying glaze?
I've discovered that if I dunk things in a big bucket, I'm much less likely to miss a spot. If I try brushing, that's where I really get into trouble with the glazes.
So even if you dunk something, what you're saying is it doesn't always cover the whole surface?
If you don't know that you left a tip out, in other words, one of the drawbacks of this is you've got to have a big bucket. If you make something that's, say, 8 by 10 inches, then you've got to have a 5-gallon bucket or something of glaze in order to be able to take your tongs and put that completely down under the glaze and then bring it back out and let it drain good and dry before you put it on the shelf. And cleaning the bottom is an issue, too. because if you don't clean all the glaze off the bottom, or you don't use wax or something to keep the glaze from sticking, then what happens is you fire the thing in the kiln and the glaze becomes glass on the bottom and fuses to the kiln shelf.
Oh, geez.
Which is never a good thing. You've destroyed a kiln shelf as well as the piece of pottery.
Sounds like you must have had that happen once or twice.
I've had it happen. Yeah, and every potter has had that happen, even the ones that can see. So, you know, you use tricks like you take basically the stuff they call kiln wash, which is sort of just clay in a solution, and you paint that on the shelf, and it basically acts as something that will come loose on the bottom of the pot rather than ruin the shelf. And then sometimes you just have to take a Dremel tool or something and grind the glass off your kiln shelf.
And what other challenges might you have run into?
One of the things I'll say as far as the challenge was concerned was firing in a kiln. We bought a kiln through Olympic Kilns. That's not a plug for them. There are several good companies that make kilns. Bought a kiln that has a digital controller on it. So basically, I just set the controls for the whole firing schedule. The old-fashioned way of doing it is you left peepholes, and you had little cone-shaped things that were a mixture of clay and your glaze. They were constructed so that they would melt when the kiln got to a certain temperature. Well, you had to be able to peek through the peephole at the kiln, at the cone to see if it was starting to slump, and I can't do that. So using a digital control was the way around that.
Can you see enough to do the digital control?
You know, this is just typical of the things you have to learn to do. I got a copy on my computer so I could look at the control face and see where everything is. And then I go out and I can see the areas on the kiln. I can't read what it says, but I know how many times to push here and how many times to push there to get to the spot that I need to be to set it up. The answer is yes and no. I can see enough to know where to push, but not well enough to know what numbers are coming up.
So are there any other issues that either pro or con with the state of your vision in terms of doing pottery, or hints you can give people?
I've discovered that, okay, first of all, on my wheel, I have a mirror hanging behind the wheel. Because when I look at things close up, I see parts and don't see parts. But if I look at things a little farther away, I'm more likely to get the whole picture into my vision. And so by using this mirror behind it, I can sort of tell the shape of the pot better and that sort of thing. Although throwing is a very tactile experience, and I know when I lost my vision, I was going to quit, and my instructor at the community college says, oh, Rodney, don't do that. So when I start teaching people, I tell them to close their eyes and feel the clay. Don't look at it. Don't try to control it visually. You know, do it with your hands, but it still helps to be able to get some sense of how tall the piece is and, you know, the overall shape and that sort of thing. I use a mirror. I use good lighting. Obviously, I can't use lighting that's coming toward me. I have to have it coming over my shoulder, and usually I get it off to the side a little bit so that I get more contrast between parts of the pot as it's going around. That gives me more sense of three dimensions. Because one of the problems that I've had is if I can see the pot and I'm trying to carve something into it, I can't tell how deep I'm going because I don't have depth perception. But if I get the light coming from the side, I create shadows that give me an idea of what I'm doing. So that's kind of a low-tech thing that's helped. Yeah, there's some things, as I said, the glazing is just a major irritation.
You haven't found a good way around that.
I have not found a good way around the glazing.
So you started out with dishes and bowls. Have you made more elaborate things?
I've done hand building too. I've made pretty good sized things by using slabs or pinches of clay and putting them together. Lynn and I took a hand building course where the fellow was teaching this technique where you just take little like thumb sized pinches of clay and you keep building, you know, according to what is in your mind. Lynn got really very good at that. My pieces sort of had an Alice in Wonderland look to them. They kind of went off wherever they were going because I couldn't really tell. I couldn't see what was happening. As I said, that's not worked as well for me. Although there were people who said they really liked what I did because it did look like something the Mad Hatter had done.
That's one way of stepping outside the box and doing something a little bit more creative, different.
It is, yeah.
You know, what's interesting about Rodney's story is just how clever people are about finding ways, and maybe unusual ways, about doing the things that they want to do. And there isn't always a recipe for doing those things. You can't always ask somebody, you know, how can I do this? And they'll give you an answer. You just have to experiment and try some things and see what works for your particular situation. So I think that was kind of neat.
Now for this week's high-tech item, some of the digital magnifiers that Rodney finds helpful.
Have you ever looked at using some portable closed-circuit TV systems or CCTVs to help you with this work?
I have. I have a little SenseView. That's the name of the thing. It's about the size of a deck of cards, and basically they advertise it as being the world's smallest CCTV. It magnifies. It just does black and white. Doesn't do colors, but I can invert color so I can be looking at white on black, and it blows it up much larger than I need. So I can use that too.
So that's helpful for tasks like that.
Yeah. I only got that recently, and I had figured out how to do this before I got the SenseView.
You know, my first closed circuit TV systems like that were in the late 70s, early 80s, and just the camera alone was almost a foot long. And then you had a regular CRT TV. These days, with the LCDs and the very small cameras, they've really made them very portable, very usable. They're all in color and stuff. And they've really come a long way with some of that technology.
I'm getting an Acrobat CCTV that has the head that swings around and more versatile than the ones that you just slide a piece of paper under on your desk.
Who makes the Acrobat?
That's Enhanced Vision.
And we'll have links and phone numbers for both HIMS that makes SenseView and Enhanced Vision that makes the Acrobat magnifier in the show notes for this show, which you can find at our website, www.eyesonsuccess.net. That's it for show number 1317. Next week on Eyes on Success, we'll be talking about new initiatives from Bookshare. We'll speak with Betsy Bowman, General Manager and Vice President of Literacy Programs for Bookshare. She describes a number of exciting new initiatives and collaborations with mainstream publishers. We'll hear about their web reader, personalized bookshelf, and their impact on the EPUB 3 format. If you have any questions regarding something you've heard about on the show, or you'd like to share an idea for a future show, send an email to hosts@eyesonsuccess.net or call us at 585-258-0333, and we'll try to address your question in an upcoming program.
You've been listening to Eyes on Success, hosted and produced by Nancy Goodman-Torpey and Peter Torpey and distributed by WXXI Reach Out Radio. For detailed information or a full archive of programs, visit www.eyesonsuccess.net. You can also follow us on Facebook at Eyes on Success and on Twitter at _EyesOnSuccess. We hope you will join us again next week for more information and updates on products for accessible living. Thanks for listening to Eyes on Success, and have a nice day.